as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
And welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are novelists Colson Whitehead, Marty Limebach, and Martha McPhee. My first guest is Colson Whitehead. He's the author of Apex Hides the Hurt. He's the author of the novels The Intuitionist and John Henry Days, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Pulitzer Prize, as well as a collection of essays, The Colossus of New York. He is the winner of a Whiting Writers Award and MacArthur Genius Award. He lives in Brooklyn. Hi, Colson.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. Let's talk about, first of all, your most current book, Apex Hides the Hurt. Will you talk about how this came about?
Okay, well, it's about a corporate namer, a marketing guy who comes up with names of products like Nike Swoosh and Prozac, and he gets hired to name a town in the Midwest. And I started thinking about it a couple of years ago, I guess it was like 8 or 9 years ago, when the New York Times had a piece on the naming of Prozac and how these marketing gurus try to find the right syllables, the right prefixes and suffixes that they can put together into the right combination that will make a product fly off the shelves. And I thought, oh, that's a weird gig. You don't think about it, but people do it. And then from writing about cities, I was thinking about how street names evolve. You walk down Brooklyn and you're on Hoyt and Schermerhorn Street and Remsen. And at one point, these people were men of a substance, famous guys. I mean, they got their names on the streets. But now they're pretty anonymous and just, you know, dots on the map. So I was thinking about, you know, what naming sort of meant, and I put these, I guess, the two ideas about cities and then the corporate namer together.
Interesting. So how do you know when an idea sticks? How did you know when you had this one and this one you had to follow through and do a book?
Well, I mean, I read the article and then I kept thinking about it on and off for about 2 years. So when I was free, basically. I was thinking, I had my list of ideas. And I generally have like two or three things that I can work on when I have free time. And it's hard to decide. And I find out that whatever one I start thinking about the most, I end up choosing. And that seems like a good way to weed out the ideas I'm not going to think about or work on.
Sure. And then the title, Apex Hides the Hurt. Talk about that. At what point did you have the title?
Most famous product is a multicultural Band-Aid called Apex, which he's named. And I guess the gimmick for Apex is that no matter what skin color you are, whether you're albino, Viking, or Ethiopian, you can find the right Apex bandage that will match your skin tone. And the slogan of the Band-Aid is Apex Hides the Hurt. And it seemed like a nice sort of it just seemed like a catchy title I could use.
That's great. That's great. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Colson Whitehead, author of Apex Hides the Hurt, published by Doubleday. I saw an interview with your recent Denver Post interview, actually, in which you said, "I'm not the snide hipster that I used to be." Would you elaborate on that?
I'm very kind to animals now. I worked at the Village Voice in the mid-90s, and I wrote book reviews and TV reviews and music reviews, and I just had like a very cynical sort of hipster writing voice I would use. I mean, it was funny, but definitely ran its course. I don't really write that often for newspapers and magazines anymore. But I found, I got out of my system, and my daughter was born a year and a half ago, and I find myself much to my dismay being a lot kinder to my characters now. So it's just instead of shooting someone dead, it's like, it's just a flesh wound. So.
It's funny how kids do that to you.
Yes.
Yeah. Read to us from your book.
Oh, excellent. I'll start at the beginning. It's the first chapter.
That's great.
He came up with the names. They were good times. He came up with the names, and like any good parent, he knocked them around to teach them life lessons. He bent them to see if they'd break. He dragged them behind cars by heavy metal chains. He exposed them to high temperatures for extended periods of time. Sometimes consonants broke off and left angry vowels on the laboratory tables. How else was he to know if they were ready for what the world had in store for them? They were good times. In the office, they greeted each other with hey and hey man and slapped each other on the back a lot. In the coffee room, they threw the names around like weekenders tossing softballs. Clunker names fell with a thud on the ground. Hey, what do you think of this one? They brainstormed, and then sometimes they hit one out of the park. Sometimes they broke through to the other side and came up with something so spectacular and unexpected, so appropriate to the particular thing waiting, that the others could only stand in awe. You joined the Hall of Legends. It was the kind of business where there were a lot of eureka stories. Much of the work went on a subconscious level. He was making connections between things without thinking, and then bam on the subway, scratching a nose, or bam bam while stubbing a toe on the curb. Floating in neon before him was the name. When the products flopped, he told himself it was because of the marketing people. It was a stupid public. The crappy thing itself. Never the name, because what he did was perfect. Sometimes he had to say the name even though he knew it was messed up, just to hear how messed up it was. Everyone had their off days. Sometimes it was contagious. The weather turned bad, and they had to suffer through a month of suffixes. Rummaging the stores down below, they hung the staple kickers on the word. They X'd it. They itted it. They stuck good old ol on it. They waited for the wind. Sometimes he came up with a name that wouldn't fit the client, but would one day be perfect for something else, and these he kept away from the world. Reassuring them over the long years, his lovely, homely daughters. When their princes arrived, it was a glorious occasion. A good name did not dry up and get old. It waited for its intended. They were good times. He was an expert in his field. Some might say a rose by any other name, but he didn't go in for that kind of crap. That was crazy talk. Bad for business, bad for morale. A rose by any other name would wilt fast, smell like bitter almonds. God help you if the thorns broke the skin. He gave them the names and he saw the packages flying over the prescription counter. He saw the greedy hands grab them from the candy rack. He saw the names on the packaging printed over and over. Even when the gum wrappers were bunched up into little beetles of foil and skittered in the gutters, he saw the name printed on it and knew it was his. When they were hauled off to the garbage dump, the names blanched in the sun on top of the heap and remained, even though what they named had been consumed. To have a name imprinted along the bottom of a styrofoam container, this was immortality. He could see the seagulls swooping around in depressed circles. They could not eat it at all.
That's wonderful. Thank you. That was Colson Whitehead reading from Apex Hides the Hurt, published by Doubleday. Your work has such rhythm, and I wonder if you read it aloud or if that all happens in your head.
It pretty much happens in my head nowadays, and I've definitely become a better reader. When I first started, having to read my books in public for book tours and whatnot, readings, I hadn't really done it before, and I always, talked really fast and mumbled, and so I guess over time I've learned to enunciate more, and I think maybe my reading rhythm has crept into the prose or something, but definitely it does have a certain kind of rhythm to it that I didn't used to have.
And your first paragraph, which I think is a real grabber, was that always the first paragraph?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you end up moving it around a bit, but this one I was very glad that I sort of found the voice pretty quickly and kept going with it.
Voice is one of those things that especially beginning writers find to be very sort of esoteric. How do you locate your voice? Some writers are lucky to get it right from the start, and I think most have a difficult time at the beginning. What could you offer on voice?
I always, sometimes I've started something and a few pages in realize it's not the right voice. We were talking before about my hipster days. When I started The Intuitionist, I had an idea of the character, and it was first person, and I got about two pages in and realized that, this sort of above it all cynical voice wouldn't work for the book, and I ended up changing the character totally around and making it a third-person book. I find, when I start with a first-person voice, it ends up sort of failing, and I need that sort of distance to keep, to police myself, actually. So, eventually I'll be old enough to do a first-person voice, but I find third-person provides a nice distance that I find really useful in getting the voice down.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's true. I think first-person, sometimes you're too immersed in being the character that it's hard to see who the character is, maybe.
Right, and like I said, hopefully I'll pick it up, find out how to do it one day, because it's my variety of spice of life, so.
I wanted to ask you about these major awards you've won and what that is like. How does that change your writing to receive a MacArthur Award? What happens?
Well, I mean, first it's very exciting. I think I was walking around saying, dude, you're getting Adele for 60. it was really this weird sort of response I had. But then, it basically just buys you time, or me anyway, it bought me time to write. I didn't have to worry about sort of freelance hustle, which, defined most of my writing life. And the kind of validation, I think, was most important. My books aren't really, I find my books really strange, and having that sort of validation from, peers and other artists in different fields, which is great, and I feel much more confident to try different things. So that's sort of the lesson I'm taking away from it.
That's wonderful. I have a couple of minutes left with Colson Whitehead, author of Apex Hides the Hurt, published by Doubleday. Are you going to be at the LA Times Festival of Books next weekend?
Yeah, it should be fun. I'm going to the Portland Book Festival this weekend, and then next weekend is L.A. So, you know, that's always a lot more fun than just sort of reading by yourself, because you get to, you know, meet people, and generally they turn out to be really cool, so other writers. So I have, you know, pretty fond memories of going to L.A. Times book fair a couple years ago, and, you know, I think it'll be fun.
What panel will you be on, if anyone wants to find you?
A panel on satire with Alan Zwiebel and someone else, who I can't recall at the exact moment.
Okay.
I guess I have to prepare something. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but it's a week and a half off. So.
Yeah, I think you'll be
fine.
It'll
be a good show.
We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any pearls of wisdom you would fling at our guests who are struggling through work.
Well, I was talking to someone at a reading last week, and he said, "So, how do you do it?" You know, and I just kept saying, "Keep at it." You know, a lot of people don't want to read your writing or hear about it or give you support, but you have to sort of push on through and keep going and fail. And when you fail, you pick yourself up and do it again. And he said, "Oh, in other words, practice, practice, practice." And I was like, "Yeah, I guess so." In three words, it's probably practice, practice, practice. But I've definitely written some pretty terrible stuff, and then hopefully it gets better. And so that's my take.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you so much for spending the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And continued great luck on Apex Hides the Hurt.
Thanks a lot.
Well, that was Colson Whitehead speaking to us from San Francisco. He'll be in Portland next week and back down here the week after, so you can check him out. Check out this book and his work as well. We're taking a break now because today we have on three guests. Marty Leinbach is going to be next, so we're going to take a real short break. Don't go anywhere. Stay with us, and hopefully we will be back with her in a minute.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We spent the first 20 minutes with Colson Whitehead, author of Apex Hides the Hurt. We are back with Marty Limebach. She's author of Daniel Isn't Talking, published by Doubleday. She's the author of the international bestseller Dying Young, which was made into a movie starring Julia Roberts. Her long hiatus from writing is due to the fact that her own son, Nicholas, was diagnosed with autism several years ago, and she's been immersed in his development ever since. Now 9 years old, her son attends a normal school in London, where the family lives. Marty's an activist for families with autism, both in the U.S. and the U.K., and again, her new book is called Daniel Isn't Talking. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you.
Well, it's wonderful to be on the show.
Tell me about how this book came about. I mean, I realize it, in part at least, came from your life, but I don't know the full story, and maybe you can tell us more.
Well, I have to tell you that before I wrote this book, I hadn't written in about 5 years, and that's quite a serious thing for a writer. However, having said that, I think silence is kind of part of the game as a writer, and that there are times in your life when you're not going to write anything, and it's kind of good to recognize that. And at this point, I was really too involved with working with my son to think too much about myself, my career, my books. That whole world of the imagination wasn't where I had to live for that time. But when he, as he did, improved so much, I knew it was time for me to return to work. And I sat down, I made this little office, which had kind of been taken over by Kids Toys, and cleared off the desk and got out the computer and said to myself, okay, what are you going to talk about? And I thought, well, there's only one story that really needs to be told from my heart right now, and that was Daniel Isn't Talking, which reflects those years I spent exclusively with my children.
So, you know, one thing that afflicts new writers, and, you know, not necessarily writers who've been writing, but new writers is dealing with their lives, putting their lives into their work. Has that ever been a problem for you, or have you ever sort of been unable or unwilling to do that?
I don't think it's a good idea for new writers to write directly about their life, because unless you've really worked in the fictional form for a long time, you can kind of get into a sort of reportage. Now, I'm talking about writing fiction. Nonfiction is a different issue, obviously. Mm-hmm. But if you're writing fiction, you really need to concentrate on making those scenes from the imagination seem real, but maybe not actually have them real, because you're actually developing yourself as a fiction writer. But if you've been doing it for a while, I mean, Daniel Isn't Talking, the fourth book I published in the U.S., it's not so difficult to work your real life into it in a fictional manner, because you're just so familiar with that form and you know all the traps and you know how to avoid them. But it wouldn't be my suggestion for new writers would always be, sure, you can use some parts of your life as long as you're just really aware that what you want to be creating is a narrative which stands on its own outside of your life as such, that it doesn't need to sort of keep underlying, this really happened, this really happened, that it can seem real and true on its own and stand on its own legs.
Sure. You actually attended UCI. You were in the writing program here.
I was in the writing program. I loved it. It was great.
So overall, you think writing programs are a good thing, good for certain people, always good, depends on where you are in your writing life? What do you think?
Maybe all of the above. I mean, I have to confess, I teach a writing program. I teach at Oxford University in Oxford, England. So I obviously think that writing programs are really good. I think one of the things I liked about my experience as a student writer, and I think that I still enjoy, even within the kind of teaching role in a writing program, is that it really creates that kind of psychological space and that support to really pursue the work. So many people will say, and I mean, it's almost like a cliche, but it actually is kind of heartbreakingly real. They'll say, oh, God, I wish I had time to write a book. I would like to write a book, but I don't have time. You see, what a writing program gives you permission to do is to test out whether this is really, you know, going to work for you. And if so, in what capacity? I don't think every writing program, I mean, UCI is extremely competitive to get into. I mean, there's huge successes from it, and that's wonderful, and I love that. But not every writing program is going to have that kind of status. But even so, I think that the writing programs, which perhaps don't produce quite so famous of alum, are nonetheless very valid because so many of us have stories we want to tell, and we have our own particular audiences we want to address, and those things are important too.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm speaking with Marty Limebach, author of Daniel Isn't Talking, published by Doubleday. This book has also been optioned to become a movie, yes?
Yes, it has.
What is it with you? You're writing books that become movies. Now, what are you doing?
I don't know. This one was quite extraordinary. After I wrote it, I did not write it with a movie in mind. But I think that the kind of style of writing that I do, and I don't mean to do this, it's just what comes out. I do think I'm very scenic. I create scenes, specific scenes, and there's not a lot of extra words. So it does lend itself very nicely, I think, to film adaptation. But the reason I knew this one would be optioned was because it told a story in which, you know, you saw a lot of drama, a lot of tension from the start, and it takes off very, very quickly. So these people are already in a tense situation, and the heat just gets turned up and turned up and turned up. And that always will produce the kind of drama which will at least get, should get the reader's attention, and it quite often gets movie attention. I think because it creates an opportunity for actors to do what they really want to do, which is to be in really strong roles that demand a lot of actual real-life acting, as opposed to, say, special effects or, you know, some other kind of special movie thing that makes people want to watch it. The drama I create requires the actor to really want to act, and that makes it attractive to certain actors.
Did you know that, say, when you wrote Dying Young, or did Dying Young and what happened with that and the drama of that book teach you what sort of movies come from books?
Well, I can't pretend I know it. I could write a book and know it was going to be made into film. I knew it after I wrote Daniel Isn't Talking that it would be optioned because it just is that kind of book that tells a particular type of story. But with Dying Young, I was completely unaware not only of how films get created from books as adaptations, but also of the whole publishing world. And I stayed in that kind of dark ignorance for quite a number of years. It's very easy to do as a writer to have no idea how the whole thing works. But over the years, I guess I got a certain amount of knowledge, and now I understand how the machines operate a little bit. But I was pretty hit with Dying Young. I was very surprised. I was, you know, writers don't have a lot of choice as to how their books get known. You can become known for all sorts of different reasons. And if it's because a film is made of your book, that's great. Another way might be you win a big award. That's also great. But we don't have a lot of choice in it, and we can't orchestrate it. And we just have to write the best thing we can write and hope that it finds its audience.
Yeah. I'm talking with Marty Limebach, author of Daniel Isn't Talking, published by Doubleday. There is so much that happens in this first chapter. How did this first chapter come out? Did it come out this way? Did you have something on the page and then start chipping away at it, refining it?
The book started off in little scribbled pieces of paper that I had in my handbag of people talking. That's where I started off, was a kind of dialogue-centered thing. What would people say in this situation? What would they say in the other situation? I jumped it around a bit, and I just had all these little scraps of paper. Some of them were actual Post-it notes. And so there was just this dialogue. And when I sat down to begin the novel, I had certain bits of dialogue I knew I was going to get to, and certain bits I decided to discard. And it was just so easy, because by the time I'd spent amount of attention allowing my characters to talk, it wasn't very hard to paint the whole scene with them. I knew them. I could make connections. I felt as though every single one of them was distinct by the way they spoke and by what they wanted. So that became very easy. In the first chapter, there is a little bit of backstory there. And my method for backstory is I don't like to weave it in. I just like to chop and do another scene. So I don't usually weave it in so that sometimes writers will write something and then they'll say, oh, but this happened when, blah, 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 and he's doing this because. I don't give that explanation. I write what's happening now. I give you some white space, new scene. This is what happened before. And it's all pretty short and interweaved so that you don't forget kind of where you were in both the current story and also the backstory.
Interesting. Now, you use first-person present tense and first-person past tense in this book. What is the reasoning? How did you decide to structure it?
Well, I have to confess that I always use first person. I mean, I have written in third person, and I've written lots of short stories in third person, but I love the first person because I like to get the camera really up close,
mm-hmm.
and I like to be involved as much in the action of the work as the, what's happening, the sort of plot action, where
yes.
they're going, who they're seeing, wherever. I like to be really involved with the thought processes, and the first person is just so intimate that I really enjoy that. But I didn't really think too much about structure. I did to a degree, but I know you're supposed to, by the way, and I know people, very good writers, who write all these plot outlines and stuff, okay? And I'm sure that's the way I should do it, but that's not the way I do it. I just let people, it's all character-driven, and I give them really strong desires. And if you give people really strong desires and they're real characters and you have some, large idea of who they are, then they just start to do stuff and you have to just keep your fingers moving as fast as you're thinking and pretty soon you got something like a story.
What if you hit a place where you feel that maybe they're talking too much? Do you say, given the characters, what would happen to shake them up?
Well, if they were talking too much, I'd say, shut up, guys. I would let myself write it. Let me say, most of writing is a process of editing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there's kind of self-censorship even as you're writing, and that's okay. But it's also okay to write a whole thing out and then say, okay, what do I not need here? Where's the dross? Let's get rid of the dross. What's the point of what they're doing? Am I getting there fast enough? Sometimes if you're writing something funny, you'll lose the humor if it just goes on and on. So, it's sometimes better to do something short, sharp, punchy that people get it. And I rely on readers to get it. I think people can read intelligently without having the whole thing underlined and brought to their great attention and with great highlights around it. I just, try and recognize and remember that people read books, read them because, they're good at reading them. And so I do let them talk it out. I do go on and on, and then I go back later, and it doesn't have to be immediately. And I say, okay, let's just shorten this up here. Sometimes even physically, what it looks like on the page, I might not like that. I know that sounds ridiculous, but the presentation of the actual words on the page matter to me, and when it goes into a proof copy form and I see the breaking up of scenes and sentences page by page, sometimes I go, gosh, can we just, can we get this couple sentences down here? Can they just be, over here instead? It actually matters to me how it physically looks on the page, which is ridiculous, but there you go.
Well, no. Well, that's a real kind of poet's thing, but I think it works with prose as well.
I think there's not a lot of difference there for some people. I mean, there's a huge difference between, I'm not a poet, but your relationship with words is critical to your work. and you know what you want to see. And if it's not quite like that, you try and get it to be like that. But I'm obviously going to be a whole lot more flexible than a poet for whom it's vital.
Yes. We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening at this very minute.
Well, you know what? I think the best advice is not to give up. And the only way you're really going to fail is if you stop. So if you are determined to write, and if you've got the writer's bug, I would just keep going, because I know some famous writers who spoke to me at various times in their life of just stopping. And in fact, I stopped for a while. But don't call it a stop. Call it a pause if you have to slow down. But basically, give it your all and carry on giving it your all, and I'm pretty sure you'll get somewhere.
Mm. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
And continued good luck with this book and all of your writing, which always does so well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
That was Marty Leinbach. Her book is Daniel Isn't Talking. It's a novel published by Doubleday. She will be at the LA Times Book Fair on April 29th at 1:30 p.m. She's on a panel with Ayelet Waldman. It's called Fiction, Reinventing the Family. Stay tuned. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Martha McPhee should be with us. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hey, did you know that Dunk Malaria was coming up on April 20th?
Dunk Malaria? What's that?
It's an event on the UCI campus that allows you to dunk basketballs to raise awareness of the worldwide malaria epidemic.
Malaria, isn't that the disease that kills more people than AIDS and cancer combined?
That's right. Can you believe that every 30 seconds, somewhere in the world, a child dies from malaria? So even by the time this announcement's over, one child has already passed away.
That is really intense. What can I do?
Just come on over to the Social Science Plaza on April 20th, anytime between 8 and 5 p.m. For more information about this event, check out our website, www.bethecause.org.
See you there.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays, 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
get the lowdown on the publishing industry, listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI-FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And welcome back again to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're here with our third guest, Martha McPhee. She's author of Lamerica. Martha's also the author of two previous novels, Bright Angel Time and Gorgeous Lies, which was a National Book Award finalist. She teaches at Hofstra University and lives in New York. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on.
It's a great pleasure.
I love the premise of this book. Will you talk about how it came about?
It came about because in response in some ways to Gorgeous Lies, because that's all about a man who's dying and a complicated family, and Bright Angel Time, too, is about the same family but 25 years before. And I was sort of tired of thinking about family and definitely tired of being with a man who was dying. And the anecdote to that for me was to think about love. And at the time, when I started to contemplate this novel about an Italian man and an American woman who fall very much in love when they're young, 18, and he's 24, September 11th occurred. And as I'm sure it happened with many writers and artists, I started thinking about what is imposed on us by our own cultures. And it was sort of that mixture of those beautiful and ugly notions that were swirled around in my head. And I dreamed on it for a while and started writing it about a year later.
Did you simply begin to write? And, well, not simply. That's so reduces it all. But, I mean, did you do any kind of, I don't know, pre-writing, any outlining, any plotting, bios or anything?
With the first two novels, I had no idea what I was doing. I sort of just began with an image, and they took me a very long time to write. With this one, I had it took me a lot less time, and I also had a sense of where I wanted it to go. And I actually did sit down with a pen and just a scrap paper, and I mapped out an idea for 8 chapters. And pretty much I stuck to it, although the chapters are surprised me and are different than what I had imagined when I wrote out that sketch of paper. But the structure was pretty much as I imagined it when I sat down that day and started sketching it. It was a surprise to me because that's not how it had happened before.
Yeah. I'm talking with Martha McPhee, author of Lamerica, published by Harcourt. Curious about the voice. I talk about this a lot with my guests because it's always one of those mysterious things, voice, and how writers come up with voice and settle in on voice. Will you talk about the voice of this novel and how you came to it?
Well, I think that it comes from my style. I'm interested in language and images, and I like to spend time with the language, and I think that creates.
Hey, did
the
you
voice
know that Dunk Malaria was?
Hello.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. I think that creates the tone, and the style creates the tone. I don't know that I specifically sat down and thought I want this sort of tone. I guess I know it wasn't going to be a satire or a funny novel, it has a more serious tone. But I think the tone is born from my interest in language.
Interesting. Will you read to us?
Sure, I would love to. I'm going to read from chapter 4, which is called You Must Change Your Life, and I'll read the first paragraph. A fast car on a wide American highway. a free soul from an exotic land of deserts with blood-red canyons and buttes and mesas that scrape the sky. A land of strip towns with drive-through just about everything, seedy hotels and lonely phone booths on long, lonely roads, a drive-in movie theater, jazz and alligators in the bayous, the heaving and sighing of semi-trailers lined up and glittering in the night. New York City, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, a wide-eyed supermarket flooded with choice. McDonald's, fried chicken, apple pie, simple things Cesare had never tried. Cornfields and wheat fields and soy, shifting lurse hills, rolling into more fields than pastures dotted by cows and sheep and farmyards with barns and silos and grain elevators. And wide-open views the size of Texas. Beth was all of this for him, 21 years old with a gap between her teeth and blonde hair, blue eyes, and the longest, darkest lashes he had ever seen. She was abundance and risk, experimentation and discovery, and she had fallen sweetly, deeply, permanently for him. Her name, ordinary American name, he pronounced it Bet, with his Italian accent that didn't know the foreign H. Bet, as in to gamble everything, his tongue transforming the name and her into something different entirely, extraordinary even. She was the Statue of Liberty, the Empire State Building shooting into the sky like hope. She was America.
Hmm. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
As you were reading that, I was thinking about something that I was thinking about your book earlier, which is your settings are vivid, extremely vivid. And I wonder if you consider setting and place to be one of your strengths, and do you love doing it, or is it one of those things that isn't as enjoyable, say, as character and dialogue, but you somehow do it so perfectly?
I love doing all of it, but place is very important to me, especially in this book, which is so much about where we come from and its hold on us, even if that hold is unwitting. And I was equally as interested in the hold that Italy has on Cesare as I was in the hold that America has on Beth. And for the pretty much duration of the novel, they're trying to resist it and fight against it because they want their love to be stronger. So place is as much a character here as either of the two main characters.
Have you found that with your other novels as well?
Yes, I did. I do. I think that we're so bound to where we come from that it's inevitable. If you're going to write about a character, you're going to write a place about place. So it wouldn't make sense to me not to do that. But I will say, when I was writing Bright Angel Time, I sent my characters out west, and I had always intended that they'd come home, and a lot of this story would be set in New Jersey, where I come from. But they never did come home. They kept staying out there. And so I had to go out there and study the landscape. And I went to the desert with a friend of mine. And I fell in love with the desert out behind Los Angeles and out toward Arizona. And I realized the metaphors there were so just apt for where this family had gotten itself, that though it wasn't, my home and it wasn't a landscape I knew, it became a very powerful force in the novel anyway.
It's interesting. I was laughing because it's funny how characters will do that. They don't want to come home. They're staying.
I kept saying the whole time, they got to come home. This is all wrong. This is all wrong. And then the book was finished.
So it sounds like in your writing process there are discoveries and surprises that you hadn't planned on, and you follow them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I remember a professor of mine at Columbia said to me, have an outline, but then know and feel free to go very far away from it. And it's true. If there's no surprise, then why would you bother writing? You like to discover those things. That's what it's all about. If you knew it from the very beginning, there would be no story to tell, really. You could tell it in a couple of sentences.
So how much in LaMerica did you need to know to continue the forward momentum? Just a little bit? Did you need an endpoint? Did you kind of need to know what each of the character needed and then throw obstacles in their way?
Well, I think with this, it was that I was asking a question, which I've sort of gotten at a little bit, which is this couple is very much in love, but the pull of their respective cultures is stronger. And so what do they do with that love? And as I was writing it, I was first opening up the question and, you know, on many levels and layers, or at least trying to, and then trying to answer it. And that was propelling me. And it's not as conscious as all that, but it was sort of that is the driving force behind the, you know, my forward momentum as a writer. And then things just they come up, they occur. She went to Europe. How did she get there? Who brought her there? I'm also interested in the sort of dialogue we sometimes have with fate. Was this fated, or did she choose it? And so that question led to coincidences, and also I drew from my memory and experiences that I had as a young woman traveling around Europe with a girlfriend with a Eurail pass or whatever it's called, and I got to recall a lot of that adventure with this great friend of mine, and so then I sort of tapped into that memory and told those stories, and they fed the larger story.
Interesting. I've been talking with Martha McPhee, author of LaMerica, published by Harcourt. We're at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any last words for the writers.
Well, for the writers, keep writing. Just write. As my father always says to me, he's also a writer, a nonfiction writer, writing teaches writing. And the other thing that I always say to my students is read everything, as Faulkner said, comic books, middle march, anything, read. And use that as your models if you can't write without reading.
Mm. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Bye.
That was Martha McPhee, author of LaMerica. She will be at the LA Times Book Festival next weekend on a panel with Yannick Murphy and Richard Ragner. So the schedule will be in the Times this coming Sunday. So check it out. All three of our guests actually today will be at the LA Times Festival of Books next weekend. If you're far away, come on in. It's 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, a free festival, wonderful panels happening all day. Of course, if you are in New York next weekend, the same weekend the LA Times Festival of Books is taking place, I will be in New York and at the American Society of Journalists and Authors annual conference on Saturday the 29th, I'll be moderating a panel on how books become movies. And you can find more info on that panel and the many others at asja.org. Also this Saturday is the Palm Springs Book Festival in just 2 days. Lots of authors, panels. I'm doing a panel on publishing in the afternoon. Lots of stuff going on everywhere. I guess there's a Portland Book Festival this weekend, too. Ton of stuff. We are at the end of our time, though. I've been asked about the music. I always forget to talk about the music that is usually played on the show. The first song is I'll Close My Eyes by Dinah Washington. The second song, usually at the break, Come Back Baby, is sung by Brian Barrett. It's an old blues song. Today I played an Etta James song between the first and second guest. I think it was Nighttime is the Right Time. And we're going to end with Etta James as well. If you want to know more about the show, though, you can go to penonfire.com and click on the radio tower. You can see the current schedule. You can listen to podcasts. There's about, few dozen shows up at this point. This one will probably go up next week or the week after. I think that's it. I am going to close with a quote by Elia Kazan, who said, "The writer, when he is also an artist, is someone who admits what others don't dare reveal." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next time.